Afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whatever it is, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Best Podcast in Baseball, Season 1, Episode 13. I'm Bernie Miklas, lead sports columnist at the Post-Dispatch, STLtoday.com, since 1989. And to my right is my friend and my colleague and my teammate, Derek Gould, Cardinals lead beat writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, STLtoday.com. As we record this, we always like to give you the sense of timing. As we record this, the Cardinals had just completed a two-game series in Tampa Bay, which completed a seven-game road trip. And Derek Gould just arrived from Lambert Field. You came from the airport straight to the lair to do the best podcast. A dedication, sir.
Sure. I grabbed my luggage and headed your way, and I was greeted with a nice cup of coffee. So thank you very much, and then off to write.
I'd like to take credit for the coffee, but it's one of those Keurig coffee makers. It's pretty easy.
That's what we have at our house, so I can't cast stones.
Sort of takes the art out of it.
Yeah.
By the way, I think we need to begin the podcast with the weekly cat report.
Okay.
Prince wanted to, of course, come in today to participate, but I kept him out because I'm being mean, I guess. Our other cat, who's still less than a year old, Duchess, you freak her out for some reason.
It's the glasses.
She gets scared, man. What is it about you that I need to explore this now?
I don't know. Maybe I smell like a dog.
When you were here last week, she ran into hiding and stayed there even like an hour after you left.
I'm just gonna go out on a limb. Probably a KU fan. Probably.
You know, it's almost like the cat's been listening to Psycho Killer talking. So anyway, all right, let's get started on some baseball talk. Well, let's go to the news of the day. First of all, Adam Wainwright comes up sore, and Cardinals are downplaying it. Derek, what's your read on the situation? Anything to be concerned about with the elbow?
Well, there's always concern, you know, anytime you have a pitcher who, you know, has had past elbow history. That's something that John Mozeliak brought up. He said, look, given his history here, he's only a couple of years. He is a couple of years removed from Tommy John. He had that tear that he pitched through until it finally gave way at the beginning of the 2011 season. And of course, he missed it. Anytime you have some history there, there's going to be concern, and that's why they sent him back. He's pitched through a litany of things that we described in the paper there. You know, he's had some back trouble. You know, he had the tendonitis in his elbow. He pitched with the flu at one point in time, and then he's had this ongoing kind of fight with a head cold that was very apparent, I'm sure, if folks watched on television the other game in Tampa Bay, how he had some labored issues. I mean, he just looked like his sinuses were clogged up and he wasn't right. You know, then the elbow was also an issue, and as soon as that became something where they saw a drop in velocity or saw that he was really laboring or that he just wasn't getting the kind of having the body language on the mound that they expect, they sent him off to get an MRI to sort of bring some relief to the situation, because it's on the other side of the elbow from the ligament that is replaced from Tommy John. But again, it's still in that area, and it's still a concern, and it's a concern enough that he received an anti-inflammatory shot and is going to need a couple days for that to take hold and see where it goes.
Look, I know that they're still leaving open the possibility of him pitching Monday, but I just find that hard to believe that they would push that.
Well, you have an option. You can, because of the off day, you can have everybody else go on normal rest, and that would buy an extra day of rest for Wainwright if you think 24 hours is going to be a big deal, which, given the fact that he's down for 48 because of the shot, maybe it is.
I would just as soon prefer to see the guy skip a start.
Well, who makes that other start then?
Well, I don't know. I mean, but this is your secretariat here. You know, you got to be careful with them. You can't have a breakdown that would be something that would go on. I mean, I definitely discretion is better here, I think. Probably, I'd rather be safe.
Wainwright intends to make the start on Monday. That's what he said. He's ready for that and doesn't want this to get in the way. But, you know, I mean, he has, I think Matheny put it, he said Wainwright has that quote-unquote warrior mentality every 5 days. You're just not going to talk him off of it. But, well, you know, maybe they ought to.
The extra day would work out well. Then if he insists on pitching again, and I've defended, in fact, we're going to talk about this in a moment, I've defended Mike Matheny on this one because some people were immediately, at least on my Twitter feed and some of my emails, rushing in to blame Matheny for Wainwright's elbow discomfort, basically saying he's overworked him. I completely disagree. But before we dive into that, I mean, again, I think sometimes you just... It's just, if you've got to scramble and bring someone up from the minors to make a start, or you got to sit Wainwright down for one start in the rotation, and just for the peace of mind, that knowing that you were very conservative, very cautious with him, and you didn't put him at any risk, you let this thing really have time to calm down. I don't know. I just think you do it. But we'll see. I'm just wanting to... Not that anyone gives a damn what I think. I just want to go on record with that. So I'm now on the record.
Just a side point that when when the musical for the Cardinals 2014 season is written, the Blame Matheny is going to be one of the big musical numbers with a complete ensemble and dancing. I just you know, the Blame Matheny, that will definitely be one of the showstoppers.
I went and did my numbers on this, and for those of you who've already read the blog, I apologize for being redundant. But quickly to review, Wainwright hasn't thrown more than 117 pitches in a start this year. I always look to the Baseball Prospectus pitcher abuse points. They have a system where they basically attach a risk factor based on how, not only your overall pitch counts, but how they're allocated, how many starts you've had of, say, for example, Category 3, Category 2, Category 1. It goes up to five categories. Anything over Category 3, which goes beyond 121 pitches, is you're pushing it. It's risky.
I see.
It's risky. All of Wainwright's starts have been within the reasonable boundaries. Category 1, which is 100 points or less. Category 2, 100, 101, 110 pitches. Category 3, up to 120 or 21 pitches. He has not been overworked.
No.
He ranks 28th. He's 28th on the list of on pitcher abuse points this season, which is very safe ground. There's nothing there that jumps out. Look, if anything, you know, I'm one of the people that a couple times have questioned Matheny about removing Wainwright
too early from games.
I don't like hypocrisy, and I try like hell to avoid it at all costs. I would be an incredible phony if I'm going to suddenly fall in line with these people saying, oh, and Matheny's worked him too hard. These are the same people squawking when he probably pulled them out of the Kansas City game. So.
Yeah, probably. So I think, you know, it's very interesting that a couple things on that. One, in the minors, they use it in the Cardinals minors. They use a frame of about stress innings or intense innings, strain innings. And it's not just raw pitch count. It's do you have a lot of pitches thrown in one inning that can cause that kind of irritation or strain that will be a repercussion several days from now? They talk about those high stress innings and wanting to monitor those. And so it's kind of the notion that not all 100 pitch outings are the same.
And that's totally true. And I know Dave Duncan and Tony La Russa really believed in that.
I think some of it comes from the conversations that Dave Duncan had when they set up this, you know, the Cardinal Way manual as to how to do things, because there was a time when, you know, when Jeff Luhnow was in charge of the minor league system, where 100 pitches and you were done, where 30 pitches in an inning and you were done. They wanted to have a little bit more of a nuanced and less of a litmus for some of these pitchers, so that you could have a guy like Cooney who toyed with a no-hitter and had some very quick innings, had some very stress-free innings, throw 101 pitches and complete his shutout the other day when he did flirt with a no-hitter, took it through the ninth or into the ninth inning. They also want some guys to recognize that, look, you got to come back from a 30-pitch inning, pitch the next one, and try to make it quicker so that you can qualify or push the team that much forward for a win. They want guys thinking in those terms, and if they don't have this litmus test, they do that. The other side of this is one of the things that Matheny has been very, very consistent on is this notion of pitcher type, where he made the point that Lynn does not have issues with those high pitch counts. He's just a big workhorse guy, high pitch count, 125, 126. He didn't have a real issue pushing him to that because he's rebounded well from that and hasn't had the injury history that some of these other guys like Wainwright has. Whereas, you know, with Wainwright, he's been a little bit more reluctant to, like you say, press on towards that 120 or press on past 110. With Shelby Miller, he has been. With Walker, he has been. So I think it's interesting that he's kind of identified a pitch type and a pitcher type and a pitcher history that'll guide his hand in this. And to kind of close it out, in that game, when he saw the velocity drop, he went to make the move, which, you know, and then, of course, made the move very quickly on Nishik, quicker than we've ever seen him make on Nishik to win the game. That was probably, for all the folks who, you know, email us and or offered deluges against us on Twitter about how he manages the bullpen, that's sort of what they've always wanted. Protect the starter when you see trouble and move quickly to get a reliever out of there at the first sign of trouble when you have a better one available.
No problem with the way he handled that win in Tampa Bay. In fact, he did a great job. Kudos in that case. I think that's key for Mike Matheny. No, it's like he needs to have that eighth inning guy that he can count on.
Yeah.
And if he has that, everything else seems to fall in order. If he doesn't have it, he tends to get panicky, if that's the term.
Right.
I'm searching for another term, but you know what I'm saying. All right, let's talk about, there's some offshoots to the Wainwright elbow scare, let's call it. And for purposes now, we'll assume that, and again, people know how I feel about this. I was going to say, we assume that everything's going to be fine. I never take it at face value. Joe Kelly was pulled up lame on April 16th. And there was a lot of talk about, well, he's only going to miss a start or two, and he's still out. So, I mean, until the guy's back, I don't presume that there will be a quick, healthy, and successful return. You just can't. There's just
no.
They have too much of a history of this going the other way. But it doesn't seem like they'll take any precautions, like, for example, sending Carlos Martinez down to Memphis to maybe recondition as a starter. I maintain maybe they should do that anyway, but unless they think Wainwright's going to be out for a while, I can't see them doing that. But if he's going to be out for a long while, and I realize, as I wrote today in my own blog, I'm being an idiot because I'm not to the point where I'm concerned about this. Well, there's always concern, but I mean, I'm not to the point of being alarmed. So I'm getting way ahead of things. But I do think, whether this is related to Wainwright's misfortune or not, I think it reinforces an opinion that you have and I have, an opinion that we share, that John Mozeliak's going to be looking for a starting pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't going to be now because, oh my gosh, suppose something would happen to Wainwright. I think he was inclined to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, this would leave him maybe just a speck more motivated to do it, right?
I'll go the other direction. Actually, I think it would broaden the pool from which he would choose a starter from. That, you know, as opposed to you go into it with your full complement of your rotation and Carlos Martinez as an option for the next guy down, if you were to, say, move him to AAA to get stretched out and bring up David Aardsma, who has pitched exceptional and has experience.
What's wrong with him? Does he have cooties?
He's not on the 40-man roster.
Okay, well, it's the 40-man roster cooties. Okay,
yeah,
that makes
sense.
Yeah,
he's not on. No, it,
go ahead,
it
I
doesn't.
Interrupted you.
But, you know, I think, you know, if you have the full complement, or if Mozeliak has a full complement, he can kind of say, look, we're going high end or we're not going at all. We're going to go for a guy who's a one or two and really change the look of this rotation for now and really beef it up in October.
David Price.
Right.
David Price. Sure.
Or his former teammate, or how, you know, whoever you wanted to go with in that regard. I mean, your eyes could be big and you could shoot for the top shelf. Now, maybe the number of shelves you would look at is a little bit broader because you're looking at not just who would be a one or two or a 1A or two. It would be who can do the innings of a three. and that changes the shopping list.
What's your best guess, by the way? And it is just a guess. What if you were to have a loose timetable, Dr. Gould, for Joe Kelly's return? What are we looking at here?
I would not even offer one. I mean, he's got
and I respect that.
He has a torn hamstring. You mentioned that. I mean, back to the fact that at the beginning they were talking about, oh, it'd be a couple starts, but it wasn't everybody that was saying that. And the manager did caution everybody. I remember it very vividly. He said, look, this is a serious injury. I know we're saying that he could be back after, but it's going to be a while. That's what he said. He said it repeatedly. It's going to be a while. And when he went off to try to throw the bullpen and wasn't able to do so, that only heightened the alarm. The hamstring is a very tricky thing. We've seen guys put down for, 6 weeks, or more with this kind of thing. And you're going on a while here where he hasn't been able to run without significant pain, and he can't take the mound as a result. He's kept his arm strength going by playing catch. That's a positive. He started lunges here, and we'll have a better sense over the weekend when, the team kind of converges on Bush. That's usually the standard time for updates. So here's the gratuitous plug. Check sdltoday.com over the weekend for that. But I think what you'll see is that it's slow going, and he's going to need a rehab assignment, obviously. And the interesting part about Kelly, if I can take the doctor hat off and put the baseball operations hat on, is that he may not come back as a starter. He'll come back as need. And will tailor his rehab.
It makes sense. It really does. All right, the other medical concern, if that's the question. It's actually not a medical concern. I'm sorry. Well, Yadier Molina, very unusual for his...
No, you can say it's a medical. It's a physical concern.
Physical concern is a better way to put it. Thank you. Didn't catch Friday, Saturday, or Sunday in Toronto. Of course, Cardinals were off Monday. Then he was back behind the plate Tuesday. How worn down is he? And I know that you wrote a lot about Matheny saying it's mental. It's the mental grind. He has been burning him out. And the frustration has fried him and all that.
Fried, yeah, that was the phrase.
See, and if you don't mind me jumping ahead of this a little bit, then you can talk about that. I at the risk of being redundant, I wrote a piece about it. Look, I'm a huge Molina fan. Make no bones about it. I think he's one of the great players I've ever covered or ever will cover. Just total respect for him. But his movement behind the plate this year has not been
right
up to his career standards. Mm-hmm. Whether people believe the pitch blocking statistics or metrics at Baseball Prospectus, I happen to think that they're a nice handy reference guide. He ranks about 11th this year in terms of the effectiveness of blocking pitches. He's always been in the top 10. Most years has been in the top 3. The movement, and remember I alluded to this last week, the movement just hasn't been as swift behind the plate.
No.
I just wonder if this is all intertwined.
He's been scooping, not moving.
Right.
I mean, he's doing a lot more with the glove as opposed to with the body, and it has influenced some games. You know, I mean, the spiking of the curveballs, some balls have gotten past. There's been spots where they could spike a curveball and they don't. Whereas they used to always be confident, even with a runner at third, well, they can put one in the dirt and yeah, you'll be able to block it. Now, there have been times where not so much, dealing with some different pitches. But no, I think there's two elements here. One, and, Matheny kind of tied them together, was they have been more proactive with time off for him. They have sort of mandated he's going to take these days off as opposed to letting him into the conversation last year where he could talk his way out of a day off and all the days off and then the stint on the DL became reactive. They've done it where it's more proactive. They've got Tony Cruz in more starts already this season at this point. I think it's 3 times as many than he had last season at the same point. So, they have done that. It was clear, whether it was in Kansas City, where I wasn't, but it was clear in Toronto that Molina was, it looked like the gravity around him was 20 times everybody else's. He was moving slower. He was, his whole affect was frustrated. His how he approached batting practice was frustrated. His reaction to at-bats was frustrated. I mean, it looked like a guy who was trying to play in fifth gear and couldn't get out of first. And that I mean, you could see how Matheny tied that to a guy who was fried, who needed to get away because he was only creating more frustration for himself. The manager gave the example of when he got a 68 hop single and he celebrated versus when he stung the ball and it got caught and he got furious and, you know, slammed it. He said that his frame of reference is all off. And then there's the physical weight of that, whether or not the mental frustration. It's a chicken and egg thing. Which came first? Is his body not giving him what he wants, so he's frustrated, or is the mental part such of a grind that he's feeling it more physically? Whatever the case, and these knees are a concern. The knee is a concern. It always will be, and there's going to be treatment for it all along the way. This is a reality for him. You know, whether he just needed to step back and take a load off both physically and mentally. That's sort of what they tried to give him in Toronto.
Well, here's my concern. It's kind of from an overview. He ain't going to get any younger.
Right.
And the innings have piled up. I mean, there's a lot of miles in the odometer, pardon the cliche. And you just wonder whether some of this is just related to age. And I do think that in advancing catching age, and I think it's good that they're getting him more time off. I think that that's mandatory. I don't think you're going to have much of a choice.
Certainly makes Tony Cruz more valuable, too, when you start thinking about him coming up on arbitration.
And he's done a nice job. Mm-hmm. He really has. Now, I'm not saying Yadier Molina is 41 years old. I'm not writing him off. I'm just saying, you know, allowances have to be made. Acknowledgements have to be made.
Joe Mauer plays first base.
Yeah.
Buster Posey plays some first base.
This is not...
That's his generation.
Molina came up at such a young age, and he seems eternally young, and the fact is he's a catcher that's crossed the 30 threshold, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think they got to be careful with it. All right, let's move it along. Now, we'll stir it up a little bit. And again, depending on when you listen to this, you may already know the news. But as we record this today, the Cardinals are facing a roster move. It is expected, virtual certainty, that Matt Adams will be reactivated from the disabled list this weekend for starting Friday, the series against the Nationals at Busch Stadium, which begins a 10-game homestand. Somebody's got to go. Most of the focus has been on the two rookie outfielders, naturally, Randall Grichuk and Oscar Tavares. And let's throw a curveball here for the first pitch.
Okay.
Before we dive into Tavares or Grichuk. Here's the curveball or the changeup. Mr. Batter, could both go down? Could they send both down and then bring back Shane Robinson? Here's why I ask this. It's obvious to me that Grichuk needs to play every day. So I'm not sure where this... There's been a little bit of a narrative forming like, well, they only want Oscar up here unless he can play every day. I get that. I don't even disagree with it. But Grichuk is clearly in need of more refinement and polish and experience than Tavares. Of the two, one guy's overmatched at the big league level. The other guy isn't, and we know which one is which. I mean, Grichuk's got a 31% strikeout rate.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a 67% contact rate. I mean, he has a hard time putting bat on the ball. Oscar's numbers aren't very good. Good line drive rate, good contact rate. I've never seen one moment where he looks like he's overwhelmed and it's like, boy, this was too fast for him. And by the way, again, because I don't want people to put words in my mouth, I have a high opinion of Grichuk. I think he's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't play before Double-A until this year. He's the guy that needs to play every day. So,
right.
So if that's what it's based on, I think he's in need of that than Oscar is. But back to my changeup question. If this is all predicated on, well, these young guys got to play every day, then doesn't it make sense to send both of them back and maybe bring Shane Robinson up? I'm not advocating it. I'm just playing a devil's advocate about this.
I think of all things, if this were a month ago, then that's sort of the reason they gave. That's exactly the explanation they gave, and that would be the route that they would go. It's not all things aren't equal now. You know, Shane Robinson's role here would be very little. He would be the third option in center field. He would be the second or third option off the bench. There wouldn't be a power component off the bench, which is something that they haven't had and talked about wanting to have. And it's not like Tavares has done anything wrong, you know, so it would just be a pure, we're going to send you down. we're going to get you playing time down there. Yes, there will be the added benefit of your service time not clicking around, which is something we've talked a lot about on this podcast, that the date he came up was such an overblown conversation with the Super 2 stuff because he could always go back down.
Right.
You know, and it's the same is true for all these rookies all around the majors this year. So I think what you hit on is very interesting because the thought it was, again, a month ago, Oscar is an everyday player in the future for this organization. Get him playing, get him ready. Don't have him come up here in a part-time role. And Grichuk is the guy who's more versatile, can play three positions, can offer more things, and is okay right now in a part-time role. I think that may have switched in the sense that Tavares is the here and now. They can find him at bats just in the same way they found Matt Adams a lot of at bats last year.
That's what I think.
You know, put him in the Matt Adams role, use the same thought, and then on the days that he doesn't start, you have power off the bench if Adams' swing is right. And on days he doesn't start, then Tavares comes off the bench and offers something, which we saw him do for the first time in Tampa. You know, that shouldn't escape people. Whereas now Grichuk could be your center fielder next year, right?
Sure.
So why not get him playing, get him ready, use 2014. He comes back in September. He's the first guy up for an injury, whatever. But with him, start thinking, you know, this guy might be the power option, right-handed, bat, athletic, capable of playing center field for next year. Get him ready for that.
That's the thing. In a perfect world, I'd like to see both of these guys stay out. But we know that Matt Adams is going to get a lot of at-bats, and he should. And by the way, I find it interesting that he indicated he's going to go back to his normal batting approach. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know, he's not going to worry about the shifts. We can probably let's spin off into that in a moment. But I'm with you. It seems to me that if the manager is creative enough and looks to do it enough, there are enough at-bats for Oscar Tavares.
Does he have to play center, Bernie?
He doesn't have to play center. He can play center on a very limited basis. See, I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something here. I see the Los Angeles Dodgers playing Scott Van Slyke in center field. Not exactly your prototype. Oscar Tavares looks good in right. I'm not saying that we can expect Willie Mays in center, but I guess I've got a little bit of developing an allergic reaction to this notion that he'd be a butcher out there. Mm-hmm. I think on a limited basis, a spot start here and there, he'd be fine. Yeah, obviously he's better suited for the corner.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to see more of him. And again, I'm not defending his numbers. He's hitting 189, 225 on base, 297 slug. But again, he looks like he belongs. It's just a matter of a guy looks comfortable. He looks confident. He's working counts. He never looks like someone that needs to regroup. The other thing that has frustrated me about him being up here, and it's no one's fault. It's just the way it is. He hasn't had many at-bats with runners on base.
No.
It's a really weird stat.
That's a great point. It's where he's been hitting. Yeah.
It's like he's been at his best throughout his minor leagues if you look at his splits. Now, we can dismiss it as small sample sizes or randomness. Oscar has always hit big with runners on base, runners mm-hmm. in scoring position. This year at Memphis, he was hitting 397 with runners on, or 379 with runners on, 479 with runners in scoring position. All right, he's had 30 at-bats with the bases empty, 7 with runners on base. It has me wanting to see more because he hasn't had the chance to bat in the kind of situations that I think would bring out his best. Now, where Grichuk has had 21 at-bats with the bases empty, 23 with runners on.
Yeah.
So he's had more of that kind of
because Matt Carpenter's been on base ahead of him.
I know.
Because Grichuk's batting second.
But that's one of the reasons why I kind of want to look. And I'm an Oscar honk, but again, I don't think it's to the point where I'm unobjective about comparing him and Grichuk. I like them both.
Right.
I'm wanting to see more of Oscar.
I just think it's interesting how the equation has changed between the two, you know, just in watching them play and as people got a feel for them. You know, no one doubts the potential and the possibility of Grichuk. It's just a question of the timing of when it arrives. And it has become clear that it's also a position thing. I mean, the guy can play center field. That's got to be appealing to a team that would like to get power from that position and hasn't since 15 left, since the previous guy to work 15 left. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of setup they have, and you could see how all the talk about preparing Tavares and making sure he gets playing time could now shift to Grichuk. I also think it's a fascinating quirk of the lineup, and I don't know. I have to give it more thought. Maybe you're quicker to figure this out or decode what it means. But you're right.
Nothing. Maybe going for a beer. Maybe about it.
Tavares has come up with very few runners on base, whereas innings seem to find Peter Borges.
They sure do.
I mean, it's been a fascinating trend here, and I don't know why, what lineup dynamic would fix that, you know, or what's causing that. I mean, I guess it says that, you know, Molina's struggles here recently are ending innings. You know, he had his first RBIs in 13 games the other day. So Tavares batting behind Molina often leaves him without anybody on base, or the fact that maybe he is batting behind somebody who already drives those runs in. You know, who knows? Whereas when he gets on base, or Peralta or John Jay, that's one of the reasons why Borges has ended innings here, or the innings have found him. Is that John Jay's on base ahead of him.
Right.
So it's just been a fascinating kind of twist to the lineup. And you can see how Matheny puts Grichuk number two and then goes, if there were a better option, you'd rather go there, but what's the better option? I mean, it's just been an interesting kind of trend because of the nine spots in the order for the American League games.
Pete, I want to talk about John Jay before we do. What's your prediction? Who gets sent down?
I think it sets up for Grichuk and Tavares goes into this 3-2 spot.
That's my read, but again, I defer to you. You're more knowledgeable and you're more on the scene.
No, I mean I'm writing about it.
Makes sense.
I'm going to try to write an audit this so some folks who will listen to this, it'll already be in the paper and they can already know whether I failed or succeeded in this audit. But of what Tavares has done, you know, this was the stretch where they said they're just going to let him play. Unleash and go. Mm-hmm. Go, young man, show us what you got. And, you know, the general consensus is that he performed well. He fit in well in the clubhouse. You know, that was also important, that he's shown an acuity for trying to learn, scout, and improve as a hitter, that they haven't overburdened him with instructions. They've just tried to give him some different things to think about, and he has responded well to those things. And to a man, the folks that I talked to, they all are like, you just see that he's ready to hit. He's,
to his credit also, he didn't become a troublemaker or pout in terms of how it affected his ability or how it would affect his teammates. Came to work every day in spring training and put it in and tried to get better. And as we sit here today, the guy that has been sort of scratched off by me and others, I'm not going to act like I didn't do that. I did. Sitting 301, he's got a 357 on-base percentage. I think his slugging percentage is higher than Matt Holliday's, or at least it was last time I looked.
It's the same, yeah.
It's about the same. About the same. He's really having a fine season, and here's the question, and again, I'm guilty.
He's hitting lefties?
Yeah, he is. And I'm jumping ahead of where we need to be on this discussion, but is John Jay writing himself back into the future with the Cardinals? I'm not talking about the rest of the season. I think as of right now, it's pretty obvious he's going to have a meaningful role. As long as he continues to perform like this, it's warranted. Yeah, there'll be some days for him on the bench. I'm not saying he's going to be out there every day because Borges is going to play some too. But does he have a chance to rewrite how the team sees his future as a Cardinal beyond this year?
Absolutely. That's actually something that I think is really important. That, you know, the guy who has the job always has an edge in keeping the job because he gets to perform in it. You know, as long as you perform, you know, then it's hard for a team to look away from you. They, you know, if you're out there hitting, they're not looking for somebody else to take your spot. So if you have the job, you always have an edge. And this goes back to something that we talked about and wrote about in spring training, that the Cardinals are definitely aware of. And if he does have a future with the team, expected to repeat, is John Jay has been at his best when he comes from a, you know, part-time role or a split shift role and overtakes the starter. He did it with Ryan Ludwig in 2010 when he started playing better and allowed them to trade Ryan Ludwig, and that, you know, he overtook him and started getting more playing time. He did it in 2011 when he started outplaying Colby Rasmus in center field and allowed them to trade Colby Rasmus because to clear way for playing time. The last few years, it's been his job. And the Cardinals recognized that they wanted to bring in some challenge. Now, maybe it would be a challenge that would outplay Jay and take the job from him in Peter Borges. Or it would create the same situation that he had excelled in previous years, where he had to, you know, get hot, stay hot, take the job. And at the end of the year, you look back and he has more at-bats at the position than the guy brought in to start. And it's something that that has worked twice before, so I'm not quite sure why, you know, when it happens a third time, you do have to give credit. But you also have to recognize that's when Jay's at his best.
All right, let's talk about Matt Holliday. You had a good piece with good comments from him earlier this week. Where, to his credit, again, he just said, no, slugging percentage isn't good enough. Power is not good enough. That's all on me. No excuses, no nothing. Now, right after that, coincidentally or not,
it's a home run.
He hit a home run, but he also before that, had developed back spasms. So, But in your view, the back spasms were an isolated thing. One's not related to the other. Like the lack of power.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. He's had back spasms before.
A lot, yeah.
So, you know, and they're related to either the violence of his swing, his workouts, whatever. I mean, he's had them. I mean, it's part of the grind of the season. Sometimes they correspond with a day off, or sometimes we don't find out about him because he's not a late scratch and he's not forthcoming. So, is it related? It's hard to know. That particular day, it was not related. He seized up. His point has been that it just feels like the timing was off, that he wasn't extending the barrel, that, you know, that he wasn't getting the lift. And I know you're big into the line drive percentages, that they just weren't there for him. And he said, he goes, I'm just racking my brain trying to come up with a reason and answer. I'm able to do these things when I want, when I'm doing the work, before a game, during BP, in the tee, in the batting cage. But then when it comes to the game, what am I just missing? Because the ability to drive the ball just hasn't been there like he expects.
He has such a linear swing. It's just, it produces so many ground balls. And I I'm not going to be an idiot and sit here and act like I can analyze his swing, other than to note that it's obvious he's always had a high ground ball rate. But I would like someone to explain, and maybe I should go down there and talk to John Mabry, but why maybe it's been even more pronounced this year. Like, in other words, where's the loft?
Yeah, well,
why isn't he getting a little bit under the ball to get it in the air more often?
He was talking about the fact that that he wasn't getting extension with the bat head, and that was a timing thing. That, you know, is the bat speed slowing just enough, or is he not out, and is he not having the pitch recognition, I guess, would be another reason. But is it just off where the pitch that he would normally hit for a line drive, he's nubbing off the not the best part of the bat, or he's fouling off? And actually, I thought it was telling, and I talked to him about this, you know, the home run that he hit in Tampa Bay, his two swings immediately before that home run were probably, I mean, we almost got nailed by one of the balls in the press box, so maybe that's what it took for me to notice, was probably almost getting hit by the pitch. But, I mean, he was right on them, and they were sizzled, you know, straight back. One had more loft than the next one, when he just was on, and then he hit a home run. You know, and I asked him about that, and he goes, well, yeah, that's when, he goes, I felt that I was right on time with that, and it was the first time in a while where he just felt on time with those pitches, and then it was a matter of connecting.
Well, I wanted to make one point about Matt Holliday, and people can call me a Holliday apologist. That's fine. I mean, I've written two pieces this year already about his big drop in slugging and drawn scrutiny to it, so it's not as if I look the other way. A 378 slugging percentage, which is where it is today, simply isn't good enough. As he said, that's just not acceptable for a hitter who has been as good, consistently good as Matt Holliday. But what I can't stand about the reaction by some to Holliday is like, okay, there is a deficiency in his game or an inadequacy in his game. We know what it is. He's not slugging. But the guy's hitting 313 with runners in scoring position. He's got a 380 on base percentage. He's got 30 RBIs. What is it about Matt Holliday, and you, Derek, dealt with this on your chat, which, by the way, people need to participate in, even if it's nothing more than just by reading, every Monday on STLtoday.com. You were on fire in your chat this earlier this week. What is it about Matt Holliday that is so polarizing to where the people who don't like him, it's all or nothing? You know, there's no gray area whatsoever. I see the gray area. I see a guy that I've written, again, twice this year. Mm-hmm. Lack of power. It's disturbing. It's got to get better. It's not the same if he's not hitting for power. Okay? However, that does not mean he's worthless. It does not mean you should put him on waivers. It doesn't mean you bench him. He's still bringing a lot to the table. He's not bringing one major ingredient to the table so far.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean he's worthless.
Right.
Why is it all or nothing with him in the eyes of these people that can't wait to jump on him?
I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know what expectations people have. I don't know where it comes from, Bernie. I honestly don't.
I don't either.
I ask constantly. I ask people. I ask other folks on Twitter, or I email. I exchange emails with the Holliday deniers, as I call them. I mean, it's like, you know, they just deny that he's done anything. And some of them, I kid you not.
I got an email saying someone said that he was actually born in Kenya. But anyway.
Oh, this is what I'm talking about. Yeah. The Holliday deniers. It's unreal. I kid you not, one of the explanations I got was that he dropped a fly ball, or he got hit by the fly ball and went off his, you know, midsection in the 2009 playoffs, and therefore never forgiven. Because, you know, let's forget what happened after that,
yeah.
that there was a save still to be had, oh, and more games to play.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so never forgiven for that. I do think some of it comes down to the fact that they saw his production and his salary, and they thought with his salary rising, his production would suddenly become Miguel Cabrera.
Right, right.
But what bothers me about that is there's this complete myopic view of the world that ignores the fact that Carl Crawford makes more money. Mark Teixeira makes more money. Vernon Wells makes more money. Ryan Howard makes more money. And the list goes on and on and on of guys who are in the $20 million tax bracket. And look, I get that it's a lot of money, and I really do try not to be numb to this notion that it is all a lot of money. But that is his class of player. His class of player is making $20 million a year. He's playing for 17, and I should add, he offered to give some of it back at one point in time so that the Cardinals could afford more to add around them when they were going to lose Albert, if it took that to re-sign Albert. He was the guy who said, look, I'll take less, you know, or, you know, you can delay the payment on it so that you can make this happen. So he has one of the best deals going at that level, one of the best 7-year deals. He's already started paying off on it.
Oh, he's provided exceptional value. If you go by the valuations at FanGraphs,
mm-hmm.
which I know a lot of baseball front offices look at as kind of a quick reference guide, he has exceeded the value of his salary investment, and that's
absolutely.
So I'm
he's
not
been
sure.
A $23 million player while others are making $23 million and doing far less, or sitting on the DL, or not playing at all.
Right.
I mean, I could go on and on.
We're not blind here. Once again, for the people who missed it the first million times, a 378 slugging percentage is bad for him.
Right.
He's got to pull it up.
That's
we're
true.
Acknowledging it. But he's not without value, even in this slightly stripped down state. So I don't get it. I do think, And some people, I'm really not trying to irritate our listeners. I think this is a great baseball town. I've praised it. In fact, I've gotten in trouble on Twitter for referring to the fans as the best in baseball. And people listening now are going to get all snarky, even because I just did it just now.
Yeah.
But there is a little bit of a baseball Amish thing here. You know, there's still like this desire. Wouldn't it be great if it was 1964?
Yeah. So he's a carpetbagger?
No, I don't
or
know.
Or he just makes more money?
I don't know. You know, wouldn't it be great that, you know, boy, the players have to pay for their own uniforms to get washed and have to pay for their sandwiches in between games of a doubleheader?
I do think Holiday Denial Boulevard is actually more of a cul-de-sac of really grumpy, angry people who just scream from their porch at us. And
give them too much time.
Yeah,
I agree.
I worry about that in the chat, that I fall into this rabbit hole and actually that I'm being punked.
I've been accused.
I'm being punked.
I've been accused of that too. People say, "Well, why do you spend so much time talking about it?" And actually, I've cut way down on that. But I thought it was interesting today.
Yeah.
Simply because he was in the news again this week. All right,
can I throw a change up?
Yeah.
Because I need help. I'm going to show my ignorance here. But I need help with something that we all talk about and evaluating that with a stat that you and I both like.
Right.
So I think the general consensus is that Holiday has seen a drop in slugging percentage each of the last 4 years, correct?
Right.
And what is this a sign of and what's the concern? I would like to offer up, we both like OPS Plus, correct?
Yeah, I'm about to look at it.
And
so, sorry, my voice got faint there because I'm turning away for a moment. Go ahead.
Well, and this was not planned, so this is an unscripted moment of BPIB. But when you look at OPS Plus, which for the listeners out there, it takes into some consideration park factors, and it also compares them against his peers. So that it allows for changes in the game, changes in offense, changes in trends, and it reflects that against a measure where 100 is average. Anything below 100 is right. Less than average. Anything above 100 is better than average. And, you know, for the most part of his career, he has been way ahead of average. So this notion that, like, okay, he goes from 604 slugging to 532 slugging to 525 slugging to 497 slugging to 490 slugging over the last five seasons, that's a pretty direct drop. I mean, you can see the staircase down. However, his OPS isn't as direct. It's not a staircase down. It actually has him increasing at times over that stretch.
His OPS Plus, yeah.
His OPS Plus.
And he's always remained above average.
Which is always above average. And he's gone let's see, 169, 149, up to 151, down to 138. And then last year with his second half surge, up to 141. So
right now he's 111.
Which is not acceptable.
But obviously, I suspect he'll pull that up, though. He'll bring that up.
He warms up when the weather warms up. That's his trend. And, you know, he's obviously working on something and trying to figure it out. And his track record is that he will. So here's what I want you to help me synthesize. Is his drop in slugging less reflective of him and just reflective of the trend in the game where offense is down, plus, and I understand that this accounts for park factors, but it is an element in it, the increasing pitcher-friendly nature of Busch Stadium 3? Because if his OPS fluctuated during that time and really hovered around the same stretch while his slugging percentage went down, the implication is that, okay, yes, his on-base percentage has helped that, but that he's just going through the same downward trend that the game is.
Well, I think the answer is both, because I think his decline in slugging percentage, you know, from 2009 down, it is indicative of the overall trend in baseball, and the numbers are there, and I don't have them in front of me, but they're pretty profound, actually. He's right in line with where the arrow's been going for virtually everybody in the game, industry-wide. Mm-hmm. Slugging percentages are way down across the board. Now, that said, here's why I said it's both. So that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But 378 represents more than an industry trend.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
You know? So, in other words, we should table this to the end of the year when we have a better idea.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, I mean, up to this year, I would say, yeah, okay, the slugging percentage is down, but it's sort of in line with what we're seeing everywhere.
That's what I'm wondering is we all write this sentence.
Now it's more drastic.
Oh, absolutely. So, but we all write the sentence, yeah. Oh, well, he's been seeing his slugging percentage go down. This is just the precipitous drop of something that was already in play. I wanted to look at it from a different point of view that, you know, and another part of this, Bernie, is you can look at his on-base percentage, and he's finding other ways to get on base than double. So he's also kind of changed as a hitter, or at least is trying to maximize the most of finding a way on base when he doesn't feel he has the swing.
No doubt. That's why I don't even care what his batting average is.
Yeah.
Because 380 is a more reflective value of what he's doing. What does 265 mean? Doesn't mean anything. He's got a 380 on base percentage.
That's pretty good.
All right, let's move it along here on the best podcast in baseball with Derek Gould and Bernie Miklas. A quick review of the road trip. The Cardinals were 1-1 in Kansas City, 2-1 surprisingly in Toronto, and then gave away a game, frankly, last night in Tampa Bay when they had a chance to win a 2-game series. I thought it was one of their more disappointing, irritating losses of the season, quite frankly. But 4-3 road trip. I like what Mike Matheny told you after the game last night. This whole idea that a road trip, he didn't put it in these terms, but I'm kind of appropriating what he said and adding to it. The idea that there's going to be one flashpoint that lifts this team off into the wild blue yonder, or one road trip's going to do it, or one homestand. I'm guilty of sort of framing their season that way. Oh, is this the starting point? Is this where it begins? No, this isn't that kind of team. The manager is absolutely right. They are what they are. We don't have to like it. We can be surprised by it. We can wish it was better. They are what they are. They're going to have to fight through this every step of the way. This does not appear to be the team because of the absence of power, primarily, that can just take off and run and win 12 out of 14 and 19 out of 22. They don't seem to have that kind of composition. So he's right. They got to put their heads down and they got to grind. It's not sexy, but that's what it is.
And this is also something that has changed for him because, remember, he, in post-game comments, had said, well, this is the kind of win that can get us going. Well, this is the kind of heartening win. Okay, this is the kind of character that this team has. He made the point that I have said that message and I need to stop, because if the clubhouse starts buying it, then they think that this is the win that catapults
it's
us.
It's a magic wand.
So, yeah. They'd snap my fingers and everything's rainbow and we're going to set the standings on fire. Cue the chorus girls. You're right. It has the pitching to do that.
Provided the horse is going to come back healthy.
There you go. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right.
The stallion comes back. Yeah. It has the pitching to do that, but it doesn't have the other facets. It doesn't have the offense. And one of the things that was so clear on this road trip, and really when you look back at the season, Bernie, and how close these games are, they're just crazy close. You know, I mean, we've seen games decided by base running, we've seen games decided by, you know, wild pitches. I mean, they're just, these teams are so, they're good, and they are so evenly matched a lot of times.
It's really true.
That there's just not this, to borrow a word from the general manager now, there's a narrower bandwidth of what's deciding games. You know, we focus on their flaws because that's what's deciding games now. It's pitch selection.
Right.
It's goofy things where, as it used to just be, hey, the Cardinals are playing the Astros. They're going to thump them for four home runs. They're going to win 9-2. Move on. You know, rinse, wash, repeat,
It's not that kind of team, man.
And it's not that kind of team.
It's
not that kind of division.
Yep.
You know what? It's not that type of league. There isn't a juggernaut. When Washington can go into San Francisco and play like that, there's not a Titan out there. All these teams are really close.
And that's why starting pitching may decide this entire thing.
Absolutely.
That's why, again, getting back to what we talked about earlier, it's counterintuitive to some to suggest the Cardinals need to get a front-end starting pitcher, top-of-the-rotation type starting pitcher. But actually it makes sense because I think the people that have the most of that, in a league full of offensively challenged lineups, the people that can pitch you to death are probably going to wind up
are king. Yeah. Absolutely. So. And then also, it's also the thing you can control.
Right.
Because, you know, you send your offense out there, and on any given day, the other pitcher might just have his sinker working, and what are you going to do? Or he might be Eric Bedard and bore you to death with his delays between pitches. You know, you just don't know. You can't control the offense. Pitching, send it out there, pretty good chance you can control it.
The Cardinals open a 10-game homestand Friday night. It'll be the Nationals in town. They're really hot. They've won 10 out of 12. Their last 14 games, their starting pitchers have an ERA of 1.84.
Wow.
Overall ERA, staff-wide this year, 2.94.
I just want the listeners to know that he had that off the top of his head.
And,
he did the calculation there.
And you know, so the Cardinals are going to have to find a way to score some runs against this group. Zimmerman, Strasburg, and Pfister will be the opponents this weekend. Then the Mets come in, then the Phillies. Not framing this as a launching pad, because I just disavowed that. I'm not, but... Anytime you have a chance to set up shop for 10 games at home, you should take advantage of it. That's not saying it's a launching pad. It's just saying you got to take care of business.
Anytime you have the Phillies in town, you should take care of, you know, I mean, that's not a good team. You know, Washington is a good test. The Mets are a mess at times. You know, there's not much there. I mean, this is their tour of the the NL East. And Washington is playing like Washington expected to play. So it's a good start, but it's not just home. It's also the opponents. This notion that they can go into Toronto against a first-place team playing great. I mean, they'd won six in a row. They'd only lost twice in, I think, their previous 15 games or somewhere along those lines. Past 13 games. They go in there and they take two or three with tremendous pitching performances, good defense, some of the best all-round multifaceted games Cardinals have played yet this season. They played in Toronto like they have talked about playing all year and never done. So that was there. But then they split against last place Kansas City. Actually lose 3 or 4 from last place Kansas City and split with last place Tampa, who, you know, they couldn't score at all. So they had to walk to score and get a broken bat, flip hit.
I mean, the Tampa Bay series was more disappointing because I think the Royals are actually pretty good. They just haven't played up to that level. Now they are. Now they're suddenly in second place, and they got a winning record.
Right, that's a good point. So,
finally, before we close down the best podcast in baseball.
We went up a notch?
Yeah, the greatest, yeah. The World Cup begins today.
Yes.
And I'm going to, in fact, I'll be watching a little later. Can't wait. Did a video about it this morning. Who's going to win this thing?
Who do I want to win or who will win?
Well, both.
I'd like to see Messi win.
They got a shot. Argentina certainly has a chance.
Yeah. I think Neymar. I think Brazil will win.
There's something about them that I agree the home field, the home country status ought to really bring out their best, but they're not exactly battle-scarred or tested internationally.
It's a young group.
It is.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. They're either going to play out of their minds or they're going to lay an egg. I think play out of their minds, but you imagine the pressure on them, though?
Well, see, no, I don't. I that's the thing that I'm having. I've tried to read up and tried to understand, like, you know, we have a sense of... You know, the pressure, I mean, you like the pressure of a English tennis player at Wimbledon. You know, we have a sense of that, of an American tennis player at the U.S. Open. Or, I mean, we have a sense of that, but when it's a game, I don't really have a good feel for if Brazil is expecting is demanding the team win.
I'm pretty sure they are.
Or if they just are celebrating the fact that they could win. I don't have a feel for that at all.
In fact, I think the mood down there is actually kind of surly.
Well, it's very militant, but that's all directed toward FIFA.
I know. So I don't. That's it.
I don't know.
The psychology of the Brazil squad is interesting to me. I saw something you said in the chat, and I agree with you. I always root for England.
Yeah.
Because I'm an English Premier League fan from way back, and I just love the whole heavy, cumbersome, impossible to deal with psychological burden that they bring into every World Cup. They just look defeated.
It's awesome.
When they, like, seriously, they walk out there and they look defeated. It's like it's that old hackneyed cliche about they're carrying the weight of the nation on their shoulders. They are.
Yeah.
They're just so beaten down before. So it's such a psychodrama with them every 4 years.
Absolutely.
I'm just fascinated by it. I love it.
So, I think some of my fondness for it does come from the coverage of the team and reading, in the British press. And then also having had a chance to be there during a Euro when you get to go to the pubs and watch, the teams kind of celebrate the national team. And it was fantastic.
So. I, of course, root for the United States. And I'm really pulling for Bosnia this year, too, because of
it's such local ties. It's
such
cool.
A great Bosnian community in St. Louis.
It's cool.
They're part of the home team, as far as I'm concerned, is when you're looking to adopt certain teams. People say, well, what about the U.S.? Well, of course we root for the U.S. And the World Cup, to me, though, is not – I stray from being parochial when it comes to the World Cup.
Really?
I like the whole thing. And, yeah, the number one team that I pull for, of course, is the U.S., but it doesn't preclude me for sort of adopting and pulling for other nations as well. You know, the U.S., though, I think the fair thing to say is Klinsmann's building this thing towards 2018.
Yeah, if he gets there. Yeah.
This is a brutal group. Everything that everyone's written is true. I don't see how they get out of the group. I guess it's possible. If they do, to me, their tournament is a success.
Throw a parade.
Yeah.
They get out of the group of death.
You know, my question is, are they going to be able to find a way to score a goal or two?
Yeah, this is
the... Seriously. So I don't have my expectations are very low. Maybe that's what Klinsmann wants, everyone to have low expectations.
My son, when we would watch sporting events when he was younger, he would always ask, who are we rooting for? You know, like every game you have to root for somebody. So we'd watch a baseball game and it would be like Oakland versus the Angels. And he's like, okay, who do we want to win? And I'd be like, I don't care. I just want to watch the game. Or he'd come up to me and the Packers would be playing the Cowboys. And he's like, okay, who do we want to win? And I'd be like, well, I want both of these teams to lose. Figure out a way for both of these teams to lose and we're good. The World Cup is the only really huge event where I have an answer for him. And I love that aspect that I can watch. You go into the World Cup and every game, it's like, oh, that is the team that I want to win this match. And I love that aspect. And yeah, you want the U.S. to do well. You want the U.S. to win. But every one of them has something that's like, oh, that's the player that I like. Or that's the country that we have a tie. Like you'd mentioned St. Louis with Bosnia or Argentina with Messi or any of the number of players. I love that aspect of the World Cup. It allows you to be a fan in every game and have a rooting interest.
Keep an eye on France. Very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Yeah.
All right, Derek, that'll do it for the Best Podcast in Baseball, Episode 13. We appreciate you coming by today on the way from the airport, on your way home to Tower Grove.
Yes, sir.
And we'll do this again next week.
Yeah,
Cardinals homestand. Looking forward to it. We'll see what the boys have in store for us. Interesting to see how the roster move will go. A lot of things. Interesting to see how Adam Wainwright will heal up and how they'll handle
when he next pitches and how Tavares, what his playing time is like if he sticks around.
There's always things to talk about with the Cardinals here on the Best Podcast in Baseball. Again, thanks for your support. Derek and Bernie, we'll see you next week here on the Best Podcast in Baseball.